Welcome back. This is Sam.
And this is Corrine, and we are two Onk Docs. Happy Eclipse Day.
Yeah, happy Eclipse Day. This is so exciting. We're part of history. And so this week's episode, we will be focusing on hematopoietic growth factors. This is another episode in our series on supportive care and a highly testable as well as a frequently discussed topic on consult and in our clinic.
Absolutely. So let's start by talking about the use of G-CSFs for prophylaxis of chemotherapy-induced neutropenic fevers in solid tumors.
Definitely. So we use granulocyte colony stimulating factors, also known as G-CSFs for the rest of this episode, a lot in oncology. So G-CSF support is based off of the risk of neutropenic fever. And neutropenic fever is defined in this setting, as well as all settings, as a single temperature greater than or equal to 38.1 degrees Celsius or greater than 38 degrees for over an hour, and an ANC less than 500 or an ANC less than 1,000 and expected to decline to less than 500 within the next 2 days. So if the risk with a specific chemotherapy regimen of neutropenic fever is greater than 20%, prophylactic G-CSF is recommended. If that risk is between 10 to 20%, you can consider G-CSF support based on risk, which we'll go over. And if there's a low risk, which is defined as a less than 10% risk of neutropenic fevers, G-CSF support is not routinely recommended, but it's actually based case by case. So G-CSF support should also be considered when you're giving a dose-dense regimen to maintain that dose intensity as well as that scheduling. So if you see dose-dense on test day, you need to be thinking about G-CSF support.
Absolutely, and clinically as well. So dose-dense AC is one of the very common regimens that we're using in breast cancer. In bladder cancer, we have dose-dense MVAC. And there are a ton of other regimens. NCCN has two entire pages on the high-risk regimens. So refer to them so that you know, hopefully your pharmacy treatment plan has the G-CSF built in. But if it doesn't, definitely need to check on that. And so for intermediate risk of neutropenic fever, what are risk factors that could make one consider G-CSF?
So these risk factors include prior chemotherapy or radiation therapy, age greater than 65 years old, renal dysfunction, which is defined as creatinine clearance less than 50, liver dysfunction, which means a bilirubin greater than 2, bone marrow involvement by the cancer, persistent neutropenias, or a chronic need for immunosuppression, or having a recent surgery or wounds.
Absolutely. And so what are some of the G-CSF medications that are used?
So there is a laundry list of these as well as biosimilars. So really whatever the patient's insurance covers or whatever you have on formulary goes. But the two that I think we need to be most aware of is filgrastim, which is daily dosing of 5 micrograms per kilogram started 24 hours to up to 96 hours after chemotherapy completion, and you give it until postnatal ANC recovers. The second G-CSF medication I think we should be aware of is pegfilgrastim. And this is a one-time dose of 6 milligrams given again in that window of 24 to up to 96 hours, but really we use 72 hours in most cutoffs after chemotherapy completion. And so this is an easier, it's a one-time shot, or we actually have an Onpro, which means it's a patch that gets stuck onto the patient and it goes off 24 hours later.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like pegfilgrastim is often built in on day 3 of chemo regimens if you have these treatment plans in your EMR. And it's important to also know the brand names because your pharmacy pharmacist may refer to them as such. So pegfilgrastim also can be Neulasta or Udenica are some of the ones I've most commonly seen. And then filgrastim is often referred to as Neupogen or Xarxio. And again, there's other types, but whatever type you choose is usually insurance dependent. And I rely heavily on my pharmacist when I'm trying to figure out how many days to give it for and what days to start it. And so what are some potential side effects of G-CSF medications?
So some side effects we need to be aware of course, allergic reactions with any medication that we give, including G-CSF agents. Bone pain is actually noted in 10 to 30% of patients who get these medicines, and so that's something we need to be aware of. Acute respiratory distress syndrome can happen. Bleomycin-induced pulmonary toxicity has a higher incidence with the use of G-CSF, so be aware of that maybe in our testicular patients. Splenic rupture, there are case reports of splenic rupture after these medications. Sickle cell crisis, as well as MDS and AML, there's an absolute risk of 0.41% and a relative risk of 1.92 with these agents. For the bone pain, NSAIDs or loratadine can help with that, and G-CSF is not recommended within 14 days after CAR-T due to there being a concern for exacerbation of cytokine release syndrome. So just be aware of those.
And then do we also use G-CSFs for the treatment of neutropenic fevers?
We do sometimes. And so the guidelines right now are if a patient was already on G-CSF, continue that daily dosing. And if they already received a long-acting agent, there is no need for additional G-CSF. If a patient did not receive prophylactic G-CSF, there is at present time a little bit of risk factors that may lead us to adding it on. And those risk factors can include admission to the hospital for sepsis, older age, which is greater than 65 years, ANC less than 100, neutropenia expected to be greater than 10 days in duration, documented infection, invasive fungal infections, hospitalizations for that febrile neutropenia. You can consider adding on G-CSF support daily through the nadir. Though the specific recommendations remain a little bit controversial, so it depends case by case.
Absolutely. So if you're ever covering, you know, the oncology service overnight, you should really consider, you know, talking about it in the morning and giving a patient G-CSF if they meet the criteria. And it's important to note that a lot of the recommendations are for chemotherapy-induced neutropenia. So I think sometimes we would get consults for patients that had, let's say, neutropenia from liver dysfunction, and there's much less clear, less of a clear role for infection related to neutropenia that's not related to chemotherapy. So you can refer, you know, to whatever the guidelines may be. And so switching gears now, let's talk about the treatment of chemotherapy-induced thrombocytopenia and the use of thrombopoietin receptor agonists, or TPOs, in patients with cancer.
So for the sake of this episode, we will be focusing only on chemotherapy-induced thrombocytopenia. But of course, as part of the workup, make sure you rule out other causes of the thrombocytopenia and treat the underlying causes if they are found. But for chemotherapy-induced thrombocytopenia, you consider platelet transfusions per the guidelines. So example, transfuse if less than 10,000 to prevent spontaneous bleeds. Transfuse if less than 20,000 for if the patient has a fever or if you need to place a central line. Give platelets if it's less than 50,000 if the patient is bleeding or needs an LP or a major non-neuroaxial surgery. And give platelets if less than 100,000 if the patient has to have neurosurgery. Dose reduce the chemotherapy for the next cycle to prevent thrombocytopenias, and consider a clinical trial for the use of TPOs. You can consider romiplostin to maintain dose scheduling and intensity of chemotherapy when the benefit outweighs the risks, and the risk of these TPO agents is, of course, clotting. Romiplostim dosing is given weekly, beginning at 2 to 4 micrograms per kilogram. You can increase no more than 1 to 2 micrograms per kilogram per week to the target platelet count between 100 and 150,000. The max dosing for romiplostim is 10 micrograms per kilogram weekly.
Absolutely. And lastly, can we talk a little bit about the treatment of chemotherapy-induced anemia and when erythropoietin-stimulating factors can be considered?
So similar to thrombocytopenia, for this episode, we're going to be focusing on chemotherapy-induced anemia, but of course, rule out all other causes. And in our cancer patients, there happen to be some like nutritional problems, or also you can have anemia of chronic disease coming into play, and treat those as indicated. But for chemotherapy, if patient has symptomatic anemia, move forward with a red blood cell transfusion per guidelines. If a patient is asymptomatic but anemic and they're stable, you transfuse if the hemoglobin is less than 7, or you can consider transfusing if the hemoglobin is less than 8 for those with other comorbidities such as coronary artery disease, history of stroke, or pulmonary disease, or having a high-risk progressive decline of the hemoglobin due to treatment, you can transfuse for those reasons. The use of erythropoietin-stimulating agents, or ESAs, can be considered if the patient has cancer as well as chronic kidney disease, undergoing palliative treatment based on patient preference. And so if the patient already had chronic kidney disease and was already on erythropoietin-stimulating agent, you can continue it. Or if the patient really does not want transfusions, they are declining for any numerous reason, you can consider ESAs, or you can consider them as part of a clinical trial. Patients undergoing chemotherapy for curative intent, there is really not enough data to support the use of ESAs. And remember, ESAs do hold a risk of thrombosis, especially with other risk factors of thrombosis. Like if they have a history of clotting, if they have a known heritable mutation, if they have hypercoagulability, elevated pre-chemotherapy platelet counts, hypertension, use of steroids, prolonged immobilization, recent surgeries, and certain therapies for multiple myeloma or hormonal agents all increase that risk of clotting. So be cognizant of that if you are considering giving one of these medications. They also take at least 2 weeks of treatment for the ESAs to actually see the increase in red blood cells. So be aware of that as well. It's not like you're going to give the dose and you're going to see the red blood cells respond tomorrow. For that, you really do need a transfusion. Also, remember, you need to have adequate iron storage to have any of these ESAs actually work. You need the building blocks before you can build those red blood cells. And there are multiple dosing regimens for epoetin and darbepoetin that I'm not going to go over, but you guys can reference the NCCN guidelines or up to date or wherever you guys find your dosing.
Absolutely. Definitely remember that risk of thrombosis with these agents. And you can listen to our anemia episode for more details on some of these things. And so that was a really great episode, Sam. What are our key takeaways?
So our key takeaways, prophylactic G-CSF use is recommended if there is a greater than 20% risk of neutropenic fever due to the chemotherapy regimen. You can consider prophylactic G-CSF if that risk of neutropenic fever is between 10 and 20% and they have another risk factor like prior chemo or radiation, being over the age of 65, having renal or liver dysfunction or bone marrow involvement. And we do not routinely give G-CSF prophylaxis if the regimen has a neutropenic fever risk less than 10%. G-CSF can be considered in the treatment of neutropenic fever if it was not already given and there's additional risk factors, but it's not every single person, so it's case by case and something that we really need to discuss and weigh risks and benefits. For chemotherapy-induced thrombocytopenia, we really focus on platelet transfusions per our guidelines. If anyone has platelets less than 10,000, you should give them platelets to prevent spontaneous bleeding. The other two cutouts that we should be aware of is if, you know, their platelets are less than 20,000 and they have a fever, give them platelets, or less than 50,000 and they're bleeding. Clinical trial is really where we guide the use of TPOs, but you can consider romiplostim outside of clinical trial case by case. For chemotherapy-induced anemia, red blood cell transfusions per our guidelines, and you can consider erythropoiesis-stimulating agents in the setting of cancer plus CKD on a palliative chemo regimen, but outside of that, it's really just case by case.
Absolutely. So thank you again for listening. Happy Eclipse Day. And if you're watching it, let us know. And please feel free to reach out to us with corrections or comments on our Instagram or Twitter, 2OncDocs.